Welcome to the Promotion Man Podcast. I'm L.A. Lloyd, and today I talk with Fred Myers about how a band gets a hit on the Billboard music charts. Fred's first day on the job, where he learns about the Promotion Man blitz that got Van Halen on the charts and on the radio. Why did Prince give Dick Clark the finger? Actually, two. Who's the older lady in the hotel lobby teaching David Lee Roth how to jump? And finally, Fred's first in-store performance with Van Halen at a record shop. That's all coming up today on Promotion Man.
Do I even start off episode 3 of Promotion Man with clean up on aisle 2? It seems to be a recurring theme here, Fred Myers.
I know. And, you know, I think we kind of have to just because we freeform a bit. Yeah. And, you know, in order for us to kind of correct some of our mistakes.
Well, let's talk about that word incubine. Now,
all right. So here's the thing. First of all, there is no such word as incubine. There's never been a word like that. Yeah. I make this stuff up as I go.
That's all right.
But what I was trying to say was it's the creative process where things are taking shape and form and it's nurtured and grown. And that's what really good visionaries and, you know, creative people do. And so that's what I was doing there.
Maybe we should get our facts before we record instead of after the fact. Oh, but that's okay. I kind of like the running theme there.
There's no fun there.
So anything else to clean up?
I totally botched MTV.
Okay.
All right, so MTV was developed and owned by Warner Communications, and it was launched August 1st, 1981.
Right.
And actually, I had transferred from Detroit to Houston for Warner Brothers in 1980. And I got to tell you that the MTV launch party was a huge to-do. But what they did is they chose major cities throughout the country, and the VJs would come to each city. So in Houston, the party was like, it was over the top. I mean, the VJs were all there. There was a lot of booze. They had couches and lounge areas set up. And then they had TV monitors everywhere in this hotel banquet hall, you know, playing MTV. And it's funny because Island Records had Buggles. Video Killed the Radio Star, which is one of our artists, you know. We did dominate quite a bit of stuff. And I got to tell you, since we brought up MTV, I've got to get something out there right here and right now. I was in a group and they said something funny and I stepped back and stepped right on Martha Quinn's foot. And she's like 4 foot nothing. And I'm a big,
and
you're
6'8".
And to this day, I feel bad about it. And I apologize to them. But you know what, Martha, if you come across this podcast, I'm still really sorry I stepped on your foot.
Oh, my God. I would love to have had a picture of that because she is such a petite person and so sweet. And I'm sure she graciously accepted your apology.
She didn't.
It's like, hey, buffoon, get off my foot.
That's exactly the look on her face. She was, what? Why? Ow.
Yeah, right.
All right. And then one more item. It's not necessarily cleanup on aisle two, but when we were talking about Ian Moore opening for the Rolling Stones, I wanted to say that that was my show in San Antonio for the Voodoo Lounge Tour, because that's when I was with Virgin Records.
Right. We're referring to the story we talked about Ian Moore last week, and you were the actual rep for the Rolling Stones, which, you know, you were with Virgin at the time. So this kind of shows how your career has moved on.
It did move on. So much so that, you know, at that moment in time, you know, we had the Stones, Lenny Kravitz. We had a lot of bands.
Yeah. And I'm going to go down the rabbit hole here, man. But the first time I ever saw the Spice Girls, Fred brought them to America. And I know that's a whole nother show, but I just want to let people know you're in for a lot as Promotion Man continues week after week.
Yeah, because we probably don't want to go down that today. But I was the one that actually intercepted them to bring them to expose them to America. And it's, we'll talk about that later,
because
there's way
story.
Too much to talk
fun,
about.
Fun time that
yeah.
week.
Today we're going to go over or define what would be called the Billboard record charts. To this very day, I think it was a few weeks ago, Billboard had their music awards, and it's on television. It's a big affair.
Right.
Well, Billboard actually was, you know, the ones that, when you say I have a number one record, that's because Billboard decided that you had earned that number one slot in the country for that week.
So how do you get there? I guess that's the big question on everyone's minds. Like, yeah, I've seen the charts and Billboard. How do you get from being a nobody band to the hottest thing in the country?
All right, well, let's do it like we did with radio and with Warner Brothers. Let's start in the beginning of Billboard. So they were founded in 1894, which is, you know, I was shocked when I...
That is amazing. I had no
idea. What they did was they were covering circuses and fairs and burlesques, and I don't know what you covered there, but that's what they were kind of reporting about. And then all of a sudden they started to focus on the music industry when the jukebox, the phonograph, record, and radio became staples with the American public. So when you say, you know, number one with a bullet, how does that work? Well, the way it works is simply this. Billboard weighs on the airplay that the radio stations are giving to that song, and then they weigh on what are the sales at the retail stores.
So there's a little bit of both, how much is getting played and how many pieces they're selling each week.
Yeah. And so what happened is they're the ones that came up with the Hot 100 and then the Billboard 200. So Right. Those were the standards that they had set up for the recording industry for records. And then we all heard of Top 40 radio. Well, actually, that's really, they would play the top 40 hits of that week.
From the Billboard chart.
Right. And then when rock radio came to be, they had their own rock album charts.
Right.
And what would happen is you would have a guy like me promoting a band like, let's say, Van Halen. Let's take Van Halen as our who we follow today.
The poster child.
Yeah. So when I started my first week, their album entered the top 200 at 148 with a bullet.
Right.
After that, it started to move up the charts based on the kind of airplay it was getting week after week through the country.
So let me interject real quick. So when you say with a bullet, obviously that means it's continuing to move up. So and then when you hit number one with a bullet, that is the you know the peak, the pinnacle. That's where you want to be. Number one with a bullet.
That's exactly where you want to be. Right. And what gives it the bullet is the momentum. Right. Going upward.
Right.
Because sometimes a record will stall, and so it's not going down and it's not going up, and so it's just, you know, it doesn't have the bullet.
Just lost the bullet.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So now, remember, you're going to duplicate that exact same scenario for country, for jazz, for dance, for R&B, for Latin. You know, so all the different genres of music are going to have their own charts.
Right.
So the promotions man's job was to get the song on the radio, and then, you know, it would start in light rotation, and then the song would receive requests, and it would start to sell, and then, of course, it would start to move up the charts, and then our job or our goal was to then push it into a medium rotation, and then eventually, when you get to heavy rotation, that's when you guys are either requesting it like crazy, and that's when we're like so tired of it because it's getting pounded to death. But that's when it's really starting to sell, you know, in huge quantities.
As a radio listener, have you ever went like, why do they play that song over and over and over again? Now you know.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
There it is, because it's in a heavy rotation.
Yeah, that's exactly. And that was what we strive for. So your job wasn't over because the radio actually added the song to their playlist. You know, your job just begun because now you've got to work with your staff. So we talked about WEA being our distributor.
Right.
So the WEA people would be the ones that would sell the stock, you know, to the retail or the wholesalers. So basically what retail would do is they would tally their sales in all the categories. Radio would tally their airplay, and then they would give all that data to Billboard. And then Billboard would come up with their charts for that week.
Now, this is all pre-digital because it's all done today digitally. I mean, there's ways to pick up exactly how many albums are sold in a week and exactly how many spins a song gets. But this era that you're talking about, Fred, it was all done, I guess, manually, just based on reports that, you know, the record side and the radio side gave to Billboard, right?
That's exactly right. And what I was introduced to, which was foreign to me when I first started, was a tracking sheet.
Right.
And I'm like, well, what is a tracking sheet? Well, the tracking sheet was literally had every name of every band on your left column and the song that you were tracking. And then on the very top of the tracking sheet would be each radio station in your territory.
Right.
And then your job was to call them every single week. And part of your job was to track the songs that they were playing. Me and you used to do it, remember?
Yeah, we did.
So I would call L.A. Lloyd and phone on a Tuesday or a Monday and say, okay, let's go over what songs you're playing of mine. And where are they? Did it go up in a chart position? And then I start to ask him, you know, if he's ready to bring on one of my new songs and enter it into the beginning. Could you describe that?
Like, well, I'll just put it like this. The programmers or music directors have a specified time each week that they legitimately sit there and take calls from all the record reps, being yourself, promotion man. And you guys work us on new stuff and ask us how, you know, much we're actually playing the stuff we're already on. And so sometimes Fred's bosses would drive him so crazy that Fred started getting a little heated up. And then Fred would call me outside of that specified time while I'm on the air on the hotline. And he's really losing his mind because I haven't added the song he needs because his boss is up his ass so far. He didn't know what to do. And then Fred calms down and we kind of come to a happy medium again. And then we get back into the conversation.
It's kind of like being married.
It is. It is.
So so that's how the radio side works.
Did I give too much behind the scenes?
No. I thought that was kind of cool because that's true. And then the record side, you know, I got to tell you, I would love to have Bill Tom as a guest.
Right.
And Bill, I hope you're listening because we could hear how the record would move from the warehouse to the retail stores, you know, and it's coming in their back room and, you know, and ultimately get it to sell over at the checkout counter. And Bill could explain how the retail chains and the buyers bought the stock from WEA and the other companies. And even the politics of the displays. I mean, you think about a record store. We'll look at it like a grocery store today.
Right.
When you see at the end cap of the grocery aisle, the Lay's potato chip or whomever, you know, that they've got that huge display. Well, that's exactly what we tried to do in the record stores because, A, we're trying to get your attention. Because if you're there shopping, you know, then the wall space, the end caps, the T-shirts that the employees are wearing, everything is a way to stimulate you to kind of go, hey, what's going on with this particular record?
I was in between jobs for a brief period. And, you know, the thing that I wanted to do to fill my time is obviously be around music. So I took a part-time job at Camelot Music in North Carolina.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
So I worked there. And here's a funny story about, like, exactly what you were talking about. This was the era of CDs just starting to come into the record stores, right? And at the time, people were very curious because they were like, well, I want to hear the difference in a CD and vinyl. So my general manager at the store said, look, anytime that someone asks a question about the quality of CD, put on Brothers in Arms by Dire Straits.
That's
what because the quality and just my boss actually said, put this CD on so people can actually hear how amazing this album is. And that was just a short way that we could get people to understand how great digital audio sounds.
Yeah. So that's where Bill, you know, Bill and his family owned and operated probably one of the most respected and successful retail record store chains in the country called Harmony House Records.
Mm-hmm.
And Music Peddlers, the wholesale division. So it'd be a treat to have Bill on because then he could kind of give us the politics of how did the record company get the end cap?
Yeah.
We've kind of defined Billboard. We've
right.
kind of talked about its relationship with retail, with radio airplay. So the week that I started, March 11th on the charts, Saturday Night Fever was like dominating.
Give me the year now. March 11th.
1978. So Saturday Night Fever was dominating. It was like the number one slot and it stayed there for 24 weeks.
Wow.
And then it finally got knocked out by Some Girls by the Rolling Stones.
Fun album cover too, by the way.
I love that. You know what? That album cover had 8 different covers.
Yeah.
And at WEA, the way WEA was set up, they were like half office walls, which was crazy because we all had a stereo system in our half office wall.
Right.
And there's 3 of us. There was Warner, Elektra, and Atlantic.
Yeah.
And we would stick our head up and see each other while we're working the phones and stuff. And I begged the Atlantic guy because I was a huge Stones fan. So I begged him that I wanted every single promo copy of every variation of the Some Girls because it was a slide-in jacket the die cutout. So at Warner Brothers, at that moment, we had the number 1, number 8 selling album in the country, George Benson, Weekend in L.A. Number nine was Rod Stewart, Footloose and Fancy Free, which was being fueled by Hot Legs. 12 was Randy Newman. If anyone remembers, Short People Have...
A little bit of a controversial song. Very, I got a few complaints from playing that song.
I would imagine.
Yeah, definitely got a few complaints.
Yeah, but he was had the number 12 selling album. Fleetwood Mac Rumors was number 15. Fleetwood Mac just wouldn't go away. Right. It was kind of like a Pink Floyd, A Dark Side of the Moon. It just won't go away. It just stays and stays and stays.
And still to this day is there.
40 million plus copies or more at
right.
this point.
Yeah.
So we have four in the top 15. We have 21 albums in the top 200 with five more coming. So I've got Little Feat, Waiting on Columbus. I've got the Ramones of the Talking Heads. Sean Cassidy actually had two albums, one going up, one coming down, because he was a big teen idol.
Big pop.
Yeah. Gordon Lightfoot, Neil Young, Steve Martin, wild and crazy guy.
Let me tell you, I had that comedy album, and it was, everyone was quoting his every joke. I mean, we knew that album front to back because we played it over and over so many times on album and also 8-track, I might add, in the car.
Then we had Debbie Boone, which was fueled by You Light Up My Life, her big, big, ginormous single.
In fact, it was so huge. Now, we may have to do some cleanup on aisle two next week, but I'm going to go on the record to say Debbie Boone, You Light Up My Life, according to Casey Kasem, had the number one song of the entire decade of the 1970s. So there you go.
Nice.
You Light Up My Life, number one song of the 70s. I'm going to stick with that.
Good. We had another rock band called Foghat.
Right.
We had Robert Palmer, double, what was the name of the album? It was a great album. I've already created my own cleanup on aisle two.
Cleanup on aisle two!
Again. Bob Marley and the Wailers. So what we said earlier was Van Halen debuted at 149.
Yeah.
The second week, it jumped all the way to 88 with a bullet. And it was a direct result of what we call a blitz. Mm-hmm. Well, literally, my first day on the job, I get in there on a Monday, and my guy who's training me, his name's Mike Diamond, and he wasn't there yet. So I didn't really sleep a wink. I like studied the Billboard charts, and I was so excited to finally get to work. So I show up in my little area. I have my desk, and it's now my desk. So I started looking in the drawers and cleaning stuff out. And to this day, I still have like Ramones pushpins that were in one of the desk
wow.
drawers. Another item in one of the desk drawers was Sex Pistols t-shirt that was rubber and inside out purposely because, of course, they're the Sex Pistols, so they're going to push every boundary on everything. But that was the thing. It was like this desk was filled with these promotional items that were not available to buy. It was all generated from the record companies, you know, because they had that kind of budget to do that sort of thing.
How did you clean up the white dust remnants that you found there?
Well, that I didn't even know about yet. That's still to come.
All right.
So I kind of clean up my area, and I have OCD, I'll admit it. So, you know, I made sure everything was neat and clean, and then I met this guy named Richard. His job was all the warehouse stuff, the cardboard stand-ups, the posters.
Yeah.
So he takes me back there, and there's all kinds of cool stuff on my bands that are coming. Like, I've got a 4x4 of Van Halen. You know, well, why? Well, because if we could get a 4x4 of Van Halen in a record store, that's going to take a huge wall. So we used to generate those things. We had one for Steve. We had them for everybody, actually.
4x4 feet, we're talking.
4 foot by 4 foot,
wow.
Styrofoam backed.
Holy cow. But if you get something like that on display in a record store, you've hit the good time. You got some good real estate.
That's correct. So Mike Diamond all of a sudden shows up, and by now my desk is all clean and neat and everything, and he's got to make a bunch of phone calls to do the tracking sheet. Because then we call him into our home office in Burbank to somebody who gathers all of that from every single record guy in the field and then, you know, talks to Billboard about where we are with our records. So then he says, listen, we're going to put together a bunch of stuff because we're going on a blitz. And I'm like, what's that mean? He goes, I told you to pack a suitcase, which he did. He said, we're going on the road. We're going to hit every single rock and roll radio station in the Michigan region
wow.
in the next 3 or 4 days. And so while he's calling and doing the tracking, I'm putting together everything we're going to need to hit the road together. At this moment in time, the pressing plants were pressing all these Van Halen albums around the country, and there was stock in the stores because obviously it entered the charts at 149
moving
with a bullet.
Up the charts, yeah.
But radio hadn't really gotten totally into it yet because it just came out the week prior. It was just released. So my good friend George Garrity, who was our head of the rock department at Warner Brothers, decided to produce a red vinyl of Van Halen, and it had the old Van Halen logo prior to their new one.
Yeah.
And then the other side of the red vinyl was the Looney Tunes, because we were Bugs Bunny. So we can do that. And then he put five tracks on it. He put Eruption, You Really Got Me, Jamie's Crying, Running with the Devil. So we had all of these, which is now a big time collector item.
I can imagine, yeah.
And we were taking these to radio along with the album. And so Mike finished up all his calls, and we got in the car, and we headed to Toledo, Ohio. And the radio station was WIOT, yes, Toledo, Ohio.
Great radio station.
And the guy there, his name was Neil Lasher, who is still my friend, and we, you know, we talk on Facebook and stuff. And so when we got to there, you know, it was one of the few times I was actually in a radio studio. And at this point, it's getting dark out, and he welcomes Mike because he knows him. He doesn't know me at all. And I just kind of watch, and Mike starts talking about the Van Halen record. And so he literally takes the red vinyl, pops it on the turntable, and after the break, started playing those tracks.
Wow.
And you know what's amazing about the power of radio, and I'll always think of this, is right there, just imagine there's probably people working on their car in the garage. There's someone in their bedroom,
yeah,
maybe studying. You know, you think of all these scenarios of the power of radio just reaching all these different people who are now all of a sudden being introduced to this rock and roll called Van Halen, which, quite frankly, there was nothing like Eruption.
No.
In fact, Neil said something that if I see him, you know, face to face, I'm going to remind him. He said off the record, off the air, man, this is too good. I don't know if I could play this. And I've never heard anybody say that about any rock and roll. But then again, if you listen to the way Eddie rips in Eruption, it's, yeah, knocks you over the head.
Yeah, it's amazing.
It's amazing. So that's why when we talk about the Billboard charts, and it went from 149 with a bullet to 88 with a bullet, because we weren't the only ones doing this blitz. It was happening around the whole country. The bosses said, I want you on the road. Get out there. Your whole goal is to, you know, get Van Halen on every single rock and roll station and get it out of light right now. It needs to be medium heavy now.
Right.
You know, week number two, it went to 88. Week number three, it went to 50.
So blitzes worked, obviously.
Yeah. And you did them when it made sense. I mean, we do, you know, in my career, I did it with the Tusk album. We did it with John Lennon's album. We, you know, certain albums, Janet Jackson, certain big artists that are huge, the superstars. You would do a blitz, you know, when that album was released, because radio wants, you know, that to play, and we want them to play it.
Yeah.
So that's how the debut album of Van Halen went. And then 9 weeks later, it's in the top 25. Well, Bob Marley had an album called Kaya that just came out. And if I look at where I was in my career with Warner Brothers, I end up having 61 concerts with 31 different bands in 10 months.
Wow.
Yeah, just grab onto that for a second. I mean, 61 concerts in 10 months with 31 different groups.
Yeah.
And each one of them needs the time, care, and consideration of, A, is their product in the stores? Is their songs on the radio? When they're on tour, my job is to expose them. So can I get any press? You know, Cream Magazine was out of Detroit, you know, so that was big if we could get them to do something.
Right.
Rolling Stone was happening, but that would probably be dealt with somebody in, you know, in another city who had them. But you had the local papers, you had the local college papers. So what you had done is radio was primary, and then anything else you could do to expose them. And then does the band want to go on the radio, or does the radio station want to have them as a guest? Because that certainly helps.
Let me ask you this, because I've interviewed, I would say in my career, probably over 1,000 artists. did you coach these bands a lot before they went into the radio stage? Because, I mean, look, everyone has different personalities, but some are so charismatic. I mean, they know how to work the mic. They know how to work the DJ that's interviewing them. And then some literally are staring down at the floor talking to their shoes. And, you know, you can't ever get them to open up. So did you coach those guys?
You know, that is such a great question. Because when we signed Prince, he was so extroverted on the stage,
right?
To the point where you're like, holy cow, what the heck am I watching here? Mm-hmm. And then in person, he doesn't want to even make eye contact with you because it wasn't anything except that it's his personality. He was very introverted when it was one-on-one. And when we put him on Dick Clark on television, and Dick is, you know, asking him about himself after he performs one of his songs, and he doesn't say a word. He uses his fingers to say how many years, and he raises up two. And the legend or the story has it that when that show was over, Dick Clark called Mo Austin directly and said, I will never, ever, ever interview that kid ever again. And I'm not even sure I want to interview any of your bands right now, because he put me in such a spot. Because as you know, being a DJ, you're feeding off of them. And if they don't give you anything, you have nothing to go on.
Right. But I can tell you, there's one magical thing that I've noticed every time, especially for the harder artists like that or who are introverted or don't have a lot to say. If you really do your research and you really prep and you can find that one magical thing, you can see it spark in their eye every time, and then you got them after that. I've seen it so many times. It's amazing just watching their entire facial expression change just because you hit one little point to them that really touched them, and you got them for the rest of the interview.
Well, and I have to tell you, that's huge, because when a on-air personality is smart enough to take note, you know, do their research, have good questions, because one of our stories is going to be me with you two at KLBJ in 1980 with the late, great Tom Quarles, who has passed on since. What I can seg into now is, so I'm going to fast track to where I've got Van Halen 4 days later. Mm-hmm. So we blitz the album, and we have to hurry up and get back to Detroit because we have Van Halen on the 10th, and this was the 6th. So we literally roll into town afternoon of the 10th, and Van Halen is going to open up for Ronnie Montrose, who is one of our Warner Brother artists, who's finishing his tour. And there was a brand new up-and-coming band called Journey, who was in the middle there. So it was Van Halen, Journey, and Ronnie Montrose.
Wow.
So we get back to Detroit, and Mike actually has to go get the band, Van Halen, and he wants to bring them to the WEA office. So I'm at the WEA office waiting, and they come rolling in, and Eddie goes straight, you know, to the turntable and finds the latest AC/DC power outage or power, what's it, AC/DC?
High voltage?
Something like that. It was out there right at that moment. And so he cranks it up.
Right.
And of course, my branch manager, who I don't really work for, I don't work for the WEA people. I work for Warner Brothers, but we office there. He comes storming out, like, what's going on? And then I introduce him to the band, and he's like, oh, okay, never mind, you know, because everybody's heard about Van Halen, and now they're here in the office. And one of the things that they were like kids in a candy store, because we can give them DJ copies of everything. We're WEA. So they got, like, they all grabbed the AC/DC album. They grabbed the Led Zeppelin albums. I mean, we, you know, kind of piled them with a bunch of records, and then they go take them back to their hotel and put them back in their luggage. So we fast track where they play the show in Detroit, and it was a good show. It wasn't a great show. They were rough, actually. And Eddie had this torpedo on the stage where he had his guitar stuff, and it was to the left center of the stage. And a couple days into the tour, that thing ended up coming off the stage. But David was also learning how to jump and spin, and every hotel I was in the morning, I'd see this older lady, like a grandma type of lady. And I was trying to figure out, why is she going on the same cities we are?
Right.
You know, and it was every Holiday Inn, she'd be there in the morning. It's like, what? You know, and finally, I asked somebody, he said, oh, that's a choreographer from Hollywood. She's on the road with us because she's teaching David how to spin, jump, come out of jumps, twirl.
Wow. I never knew that.
Yeah. Now I have the band by myself in Flint, Michigan. And at this point, it's Black Sabbath, who are on tour, and they're a Warner Brother artist. So it's now Van Halen and Black Sabbath. So Noel Monk was the manager, and I'm brand new. And Mike Diamond had taught me, and he left, and he's gone. So I'm on my own. I'm flying solo as a Warner Brother rep. And so Noel Monk says, here's the deal, Fred. You need Sharpies. And he said, you need our buttons, our Van Halen buttons. And he says, I don't mind if the band signs people's pieces of paper and whatnot after the in-store. But our goal at the in-store, obviously, is to sell as many albums as possible. So as you're taking them out, if they stop to sign stuff, I don't mind. He said, but let's focus on selling some records.
Yeah.
So I forgot to get a limo. So they ended up in my car and they're hungry. So we go to McDonald's and we get some burgers. And then we head to a radio station in Flint, Michigan called WWCK-FM in Flint.
Okay.
And again, like you said, the DJ, it's like, can he take control or does the band take control? Well, at that moment, this is probably their fourth or fifth, radio interview ever.
Oh, wow.
Alex loves Schlitz malt liquor, so he brought some with him. And his trick that day was to show everybody how he could drink it without any hands.
Okay.
Which meant that he had to somehow just put it in his mouth, put his hands behind his back, and it would go all over the place.
Right.
And the poor DJ's going, we have electronics all over in here, so stay away from my board. And everybody's like all over the place, and it was utter chaos. But, while the chaos was going on, the listener was hearing a Van Halen track. So they were interviewing, I think it was David, because David would always come to the front and do a lot of the talking. But what a lot of people don't know is Alex was the leader of the band.
Really?
Alex was the leader of the band and was really the one that really did a lot of the bigger decisions. And Eddie, he's really a great guy, but he was so distracted by his guitar. Mm-hmm. I mean, he would work on it at night. I never hung out with him as much because he would take a six-pack and go back to his room and work on his guitar. But Michael was the nicest guy. Oh, my gosh. Michael's like from Chicago. He's just the nicest guy and always was the nicest guy.
And still is. I started to say still is.
Yeah. He's just a super cool guy. So it's chaos in the studio. And I say to, I go by the mic and I say, and by the way, we're going to be at Grapevine Records right after this. So come on out and meet the band. We're going to, and so I step up to the mic and I couldn't believe I did that. But my job is to sell records. So I'm on, game on. So we're finished with the interview and I can't say the guy had control ever.
I can only imagine.
So we end up going to the record store. Well, it's packed. Parking lot's packed, everything's packed, and I'm in my car with the band. They're in my car because I forgot to get a limo, which I never, from that point forward, I knew, but got screwed up.
Yeah.
So there's this beautiful girl running across the parking lot, and I stop her, and with my hand, I'm going, come here. So she comes over to me, and I go, what's going on? And she was like so flustered because I had stopped her from her ultimate goal, which is to get in the store. And she goes, Van Halen's here and I don't have time to talk to you, and leaves.
Wow.
And the band just starts cracking up because they were right there. They were like right there in the car. And that was our bonding moment because we just all just started laughing like crazy. And then as I did a U-turn behind the store, the way it works is they had security guards there. They opened the back doors. The band went right through the doors and they had this huge line of tables and the crowd, and it was like, game on.
Wow.
Yep. And that was like my first adventure with a touring rock band on my first week of the job.
If you're going to start off with a great career in the record industry, I would say you had a great way to get it underway, man.
So I have so many Van Halen stories I'm going to share with you, and I can't wait to get to them.
Well, I think we've kind of at least set up enough on this podcast today to kind of give people at least, if you've listened to this one and the first two, you kind of know a little bit of the history of Warner Brothers. You know a little bit of history of radio and how radio and the record industry started working together. And then how retail comes into the picture. When you used to go to a record store to buy your albums and then how it was all coming to fruition to get that number one with the bullet. So I think we've really educated a lot of folks. We hopefully have entertained you a little bit with some fun stories, too. So I think from here on out, that's kind of what a little bit of Promotion Man is going to be about, is just some of the crazy antics that you experienced and seen on the road and that could lead to several podcasts. So,
no question about it. So again, I hope you guys enjoy this. I hope you're willing to turn your friends and family onto this, and we will continue to bring out a podcast once a week. It's going to be a wild ride.
Promotion Man, the true backstories of the most iconic bands in the world, told by Fred Myers and interviewed by L.A. Lloyd. Get involved and interact on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Links at promotion-man.com. Download the weekly Promotion Man podcast on Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Google Play, or your favorite provider. Thanks for listening.